Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends. Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Morning, everybody. Welcome to a very special episode of Thank Goodness It's Folk with me, James Fagan, and Sam Hindley, broadcasting around the world on www.sheffieldlive.org, in Sheffield on 93.2 FM and on digital radio as well. Or you might be listening later on Mixcloud. We have a fascinating guest for you today, Ian A. Anderson, not Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull, but Ian A. Anderson, who you may know from his work as a blues, folk and traditional musician, primarily on guitar and singing. You might know him from his work with Tiger Moth, the Kaylee Band. You might know him from his work with Maggie Holland, the Hot Vultures. You might know him from a variety of brilliant collaborations and shows he's put on over the years, or his early work in the 60s and 70s at folk clubs like The Cousins, as it was known in London, or the Bristol Troubadour in Bristol, of course. You might know him as the founder, co-founder of Southern Rag, which became Folk Roots, the probably single most important magazine on the English folk scene for nearly 40 years after it became Folk Roots and then F Roots, and that was a major part of Ian's life, as was the promotion of music from countries outside the British Isles, a term which became known as world music, was at the centre of Ian's work for many years as well. And he tirelessly promoted music, especially from Africa, in England and beyond, in his many years as a promoter. A long and exhaustive career summarised beautifully in his new book, which is called Alien Water. And it's that we'll be talking to Ian Anderson about today. Alien Water is a 320-page book, which you can get from Ghosts from the Basement. And we'll talk to Ian Anderson shortly here on Thank Goodness It's Folk. I hope you can stick with us for 2 hours of chat and music. Thanks for your company.
Thank you.
started the program today with Swag Cibarel after the sad news reached us that Swag Cibarel, one of the most important guitarists in folk music generally, and especially the music of Brittany, has passed away at the age of 70, and it's a huge shock and a great loss. And we send our condolences to his many, many colleagues, friends and family. That was a beautiful track, a duet with Cedric Lebezec and from the album Duo Libre, and it was Côte Bras 3. Yes, greatly sad to hear about his passing. A true great in the world of guitar. I'll play you a little bit of Cornog, one of my very favourite Swag Cibarel collaborations, a fantastic Breton band, and then we'll be talking to Ian Anderson about his wonderful book Alien Water. Welcome to Thank Goodness It's Folk, Ian. It's high time we had a chat. I've seized this opportunity to coincide just after the release of your magnificent chronology of your 6 decades, in your words, paddling in unpopular music. The book is called Alien Water, for reasons I'm sure you'll explain to the listeners in a moment. First of all, my overall impression, having read this book from cover to cover, is that you've been quite busy, haven't you?
Yes, quite a lot. It's the problem is once you become a civilian, it's sort of hard to stop.
Well, congratulations on actually finishing it, because I think one of the things for anyone trying to write a memoir of such a long period of life and such a rich involvement in any particular field, in your case, roots music, folk music, world music, and acoustic music, it must have been quite hard actually putting a full stop at the end and saying that's enough for now. How did you go about stopping writing, let alone starting it?
Well, like everything else, the lockdown period with COVID put a full stop to pretty much everything. At that point I was gigging a lot again, and obviously that stopped. Yeah. And it never really, like for most old people, it never picked up again afterwards, and yeah. And that seemed like a good sort of place to finish.
Ian, you've been associated very much with Western originally, and then Bristol, and London as well, and some time back in Bristol, places which were, especially in the case of London and Bristol during the 60s, absolutely formative in what you call, I think very interestingly, a reimagining of traditional folk music as opposed to revival, and I might come back to that in a moment. But you're currently in Cambridge. How's that working out for you?
It's interesting. I've got the least social life here that I had in any of those places. It's a strange scene. When I moved over here, one local musician who's a good friend said, sort of, you're going to find it a bit buttoned up around here. And I didn't know what he meant, but I do now.
Well, I guess, you know, you've always liked to innovate and start things where you are. And I imagine that although you are retired, you will be... I imagine there are a few things brewing, and you've probably already checked out the local cafe scene and worked out where you might encourage some folk music.
Well, there's a couple of folk clubs in Cambridge. The one I go to is the one called the Black Fen, which is because they have floor spots there. The other club just has like a book guest and a support act. And so I tend to go to the Black Fen because they let me play.
You know, I've already, before we came on air for this interview, I've already given a summary of, sort of a broad summary of what you've done for any of our listeners who may not have come across your extensive work before. So we can take that as read in terms of an introduction to all of the multitude of things that you've done in your life. But I want to just quickly take you right back, because this, I want to tell people that the book is, it does cover... Well, your life from birth, really, and it talks a little bit about your very early days, and it talks you talk about growing up in Weston-super-Mare, but you also talk about the revelation as a young man of discovering particularly blues music, and I just want to go back to that, if you wouldn't mind, because it seems clear reading that there were several attempts to kind of put a round peg in a square hole, or vice versa with you. For example, you were clearly excelling in languages and writing at school, but you ended up doing maths and physics. This seems to be, and then you ended up in an accountancy firm. And it seems to me that you already knew on some level that perhaps that wasn't going to be you forever.
Oh, I knew even before I left school. I mean, as I say in the book, I think it was the summer of 1963, 64, thereabouts, I wrote round all the record companies and asked what jobs might be open. But I mean, you know, basically to keep my father happy, I went and worked in an office. But I spent the whole time there trying to get out. I lasted about 2 years. And I mean, it all came to a head in what we historically know as the Summer of Love, man, 1967. There's no way you could do that and go into an office on Monday morning. So in the kind of the April or May of that year, I got the heck out. Most of the time, then I was, you know, weekends I was hitching up to London to go to see all-nighters at the cousins and things like that.
Yeah. But it was actually a bar or a cafe bar in Weston called the Swahili Bar, I believe, where you first heard, is that right, that you first heard some of the music that turned you right on?
Well, the direct line was, I mean, I'd already got interested in a little bit, kind of was aware of what was going on in sort of folk and the more sort of commercial end of blues, but the day I walked into the school physics laboratory one Friday lunchtime, and as where they had the record club, and somebody put on a Muddy Waters EP, and it completely, as we say in that part of the country, blew up my noodle. And I asked this guy, you know, where do you find people who know about this music? And he said, well, there's this coffee bar up near the art college. And so I headed up there straight after school, just in time to get out of my uniform, look a bit more presentable, cycled like crazy to the end of the town. And as I say, it's hardly an exaggeration to say I didn't leave there for about 3 years. It didn't have a jukebox. It had a record player behind the coffee bar. And a lot of those people from the art college who seemed to be well into music brought LPs in and left them there. Crazy people. Who'd do that? And there was somebody there had a sister in America who was sending records over. So, you know, like the first Dylan album and stuff like that turned up not long after it was released. But, you know, all sorts of jazz from 1920s up to the 50s and what have you, and folk and blues, and just completely turned my mind, you know.
Ian, something that struck me about reading about those early days for you in the 60s and into the early 1970s is just how different it was, and discovering music, and it wasn't just on tap for people now. It wasn't just a constant stream of available things that come like a wave past people now. You had to know people, you had to be interested enough to go and find it, and you had to get lucky in some ways in terms of who you might have met at a sensitive time. It was so different then.
Yeah, I mean, I became a magazine junkie fairly earlier on by going up to London and visiting, well, Collett's and Dobell's folk record shops, which were sort of rare oases in those days, and picking up, you know, the English folk magazines like Folk Scene and Sing, but also the American ones like Sing Out and the Boston Broadside and Little Sandy Review, and, you know, just reading them and making notes and then thinking, I have to hear this record. The only way you could hear the record in those days, you can go online and listen to something on YouTube or whatever, or pardon the expression, Spotify. But you know, if you wanted to hear a record, you either had to know somebody who had it or you had to buy it.
Yep, absolutely. Ian, let's listen to Muddy Waters now. But just before we do, I wonder if you can tell me what it is about this track. This is the one that is from your chosen playlist to represent, so you know what the track is already. And I wonder if you can just tell me what it is that you remember. What specifically was the impact of this man and his voice?
Well, it was just so urgent. You know, it's cutting. It manages to be subdued and wild at the same time. But there's something in there. It's a person speaking straight to you. I mean, at that time, I didn't know that this track was recorded only 2 years after I was born. I knew nothing. It was just, what is this incredible music?
Child, don't you wanna go? Woman, I'm trouble. I be all good now. Well, babe, I just can't be satisfied, and I just can't keep on. Well, I feel like snapping pistol in your face. I'm gonna let some graveyard lord be her resting place. Woman, I'm trouble, I be all wood mine. Well, baby, I can't never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on. I didn't see not a doggone thing. Woman, I was trouble. I was gone with mine. Well, honey, I could never be satisfied, and I just couldn't keep on. Well, I know my little baby, she gonna jump and shout. That old train be late, man, Lord, and I come walking out. I be trouble. I be all right, man. Well, honey, ain't no way to work for me to be satisfied, and I just can't keep on.
So, Ian, an incredibly heady time for you. You actually saw Bo Diddley, you saw the Stones, you saw Bob Dylan, you saw the Animals, all in their early days. That's quite a lineup of musicians to see at an early age, isn't it?
Well, it is, but you know, for example, in the 1960s, there was this annual tour that came round called the American Folk Blues Festival once a year, and it included virtually every single living great blues musician, including all the ones from the 20s and 30s who were being rediscovered, like Sleepy John Estes and Son House and so on, and plus, you know, the then contemporary people like Sonny Boy Williamson and Howlin' Wolf and people like that. When you say to people, I saw all those artists, Little Walter, people like that, they kind of look at you as if you're some kind of god. But actually, all you did was you went and bought a concert ticket once a year. Right. You weren't anything special. You just went out and saw them because you could.
At what point did you decide that you could do blues, that you could make the sounds a bit like the sounds that you were hearing, and that was an okay thing to do?
Well, you know, when you're 16 in Weston-super-Mare, you can do whatever you like. You know, if you decide you want to be a Mississippi cotton picker, well, you go off and become one. It doesn't seem completely absurd. And we hadn't we hadn't heard of things like cultural appropriation and silly accents and stuff like that in those days. But I mean, the person who really convinced me was somebody who became lifetime hero and friend, sadly finally passed away last year, was a man called Spider John Kerner, who played blues, but he played it like himself. He didn't copy those old guys. He'd obviously assimilated a lot of stuff in there, but he got past that thing of that people do of copying records, and he'd become himself, and he stayed that for the rest of his life. And I guess a little dim light came in there somewhere that you could do that.
When you're walking along with me, don't you worry about a thing now, honey, it's all right, you see. I'm a good luck child, honey, don't you worry about a thing. If you ain't got no money, baby, then that's all right, too. Just as long as you stick with me, the good luck will come to you. I'm a good luck child, honey, don't you worry about a thing, yeah, honey. Yeah, I don't need no good luck charm. I don't need no lucky star. Oh, hold the phone, good luck, and everybody knows it's true. I'm the good luck child, honey, don't you worry about a thing for you, honey. Yeah, I've had my hard times and things was going wrong. I ain't gonna worry myself, I'll be the good luck coming on. I'm the good luck child, honey, don't you worry about a thing. Yeah, now people from all over the world, everything was going bad. I suppose they're right, but I ain't gonna worry, cause I know it drive me mad. I'm the good luck child, honey, don't you worry about a thing. Yeah, all right. Yeah, if a black cat crawls your path, better mama when you're walking along with me. Don't you worry about a thing now, honey, it's all right, you see. I'm the good luck child, honey, don't you worry about a thing.
The first main thing that I tried to do a few years further on when I realised it was completely absurd trying to be a Mississippi cotton picker was listening to one of my recordings and thinking, why am I singing in this fake American accent? And at the time, although I didn't really realise it, I'd been listening to people like Davy Graham and Shirley Collins, who sang in their speaking accents. And at the time, you know, like I'm sure quite a few other people, I thought that was a little bit weird. But actually, it was everybody else who was weird. They were normal. Yeah.
I mounted again, and on my ten toes I rode. beating his drum.
Could you just maybe elaborate slightly on the impact of Shirley in your life and her vocal style particularly?
Well, yes, obviously the singing thing, but I just love that. I mean, Shirley's such a free spirit. I love the fact that she doesn't take any prisoners these days. You know, the stories that she tells about those times and the stuff that she went through and has got through with all the people who'd done her wrong. I'm just so impressed. But then later on, she was incredibly supportive of, you know, musical efforts. I mean, there's several big items of playing which came about entirely because of her. And then the title of the book, you said we should come around to that. I mean, Shirley, in her long period when she wasn't singing, David Suff put together that wonderful box set of Shirley's recordings called, I think it's called Within Sound. And on there is this song called Lord Allanwater. And she noted, because Shirley always writes, you know, impeccable sleeve notes, where she got stuff from. And she said, you know, this was recorded by Ralph Vaughan Williams in 1904 in Horsham from somebody called E.A. Steers, S-T-E-A-R-S. And I, right, that's my mother's maiden name, and they came from around there. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it turned out to be my great-grandmother, Emily Agnes Steers. And but then Malcolm Taylor at Cecil Sharp House photocopied me the original Vaughan Williams notes, and scribbled at the top is the title. And it actually, if you look at his awful handwriting, it looks like Lord Allanwater.
Hence the title of the book. And actually, that's a very moving section when you discuss realizing your connection there to a collected folk singer. I think it's I know Paul Sarton, our dear late great friend Paul Sarton, also had connections to somebody who was collected in a similar way, and it's lovely. It's a lovely thing to know about your background.
Yeah. And the icing on the cake came because my mother was heavily into genealogy. She eventually tracked down one of Cecil Sharp's informants in Somerset, who was collected as well. So I have ethnic purity on both sides of my family tree.
There you go. Folk cred. I'm sure that wasn't considered in your EFDSS badge, but it wouldn't have hurt. It wouldn't have hurt. So, Ian, there's actually a recording that you've sent me of Lord Allanwater, not Allanwater, but Lord Allanwater, to which you have a personal and familial connection. Tell us about this track we're about to hear.
Well, this is what you might call an exclusive, I think you could say. It's been out on YouTube for a few years because I recorded two or three live YouTube videos in the Wardrobe Theatre in Bristol, and
including a very fine video of you appearing as what's become your character, the crow. It's a fantastic costume. Who made that costume? It's absolutely brilliant.
That's Alex Merry from Boss Morris, who also designed the wonderful cover on the book. Yeah, so I just decided at that point we did record Lord Allanwater back in the days of the Blue Blokes 3 with me and Ben Mandelson and Lou Edmonds from PIL. But I started finally figured out a way of playing it myself. And I was quite pleased to get it to Darren. People seem to like it live.
Well, great. And thank you for sending it. Here's an exclusive track from Ian A. Anderson. This is Lord Alan Water.
Has written a long letter and sealed it up with gold and sent it off to Lord Alan Water to read it if he could. Well, the first few lines Lord Alan Water read, they filled him with surprise. The next few lines Lord Alan Water read, well, the tears fell from his eyes. Well, he went up to his lady's room, he took the stairs at speed, saying, it's up to that London I must go, where I'm sure there is great need. Well, if it's up to that London you must go, then before you go away, I'll make your will, my dear, she said, lest you should go astray. Saddle up his white steed, cause it's up to that London he must go, where he's sure there is great need. And as he put his foot into the stirrup, the other one across the steed, well, the three gold rings from his fingers burst, and his nose began to bleed. And as he riding all along the road, his horse fell against a stone. There are signs and there's portents, and that, said he, I'm sure I'll never return. Riding up a London street, close by to the old white hall, the lords and the ladies stood looking so hard, and a traitor he was called. And up and spoke a grey-haired man with a broad axe in his hand. Deliver yourself, Lord Alan Water, your life's at my call. Well, my life I do not value at all, my life I give to thee, and the black velvet cloak that I have on my back, you can take it for your fee. The man gave a mighty blow. Well, there lies the head of a traitor, he said, but it answered and it said no.
talking to Ian Anderson about his brilliant book, Alien Water, which I recommend that you all get. It is available, like all of Ian's back catalogue, or most of it, of things that he has been responsible for releasing on the variety of record labels he's instigated over the years, and old recordings. It's Ghosts from the Basement. And you can go to ghostsfromthebasement.com, which is Ian's website. And Ian, you, like many artists now, have chosen Bandcamp to sell your merchandise and your books and your CDs and those of your friends who you've recorded over the years. It does seem to be a fair trade place, if you know what I mean, for artists.
They don't rip off artists. They're the most artist-friendly web shop. But I mean, the reason that we did it independently was I did actually have three publishers interested in it when I finished it, but they all said we can't put it out till the end of 2026. And I'm thinking, well, this year is my 60th anniversary of my first gig. I want it out this year anyway. With Trump in action, who knows whether we'll have a world by the end of 2026, so let's just get it out.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that you did that, and I'm glad you got it out now. And there is something nice and round about the numbers involved, and 60 years and 40 years of F Roots as well, but we'll come back to that shortly. Ian, I would like to play, for people who haven't necessarily heard your early work, I'd like to play a couple of bits from your, I think this is your first record, Ian Anderson's Country Blues Band. Is that the first album that was released under your name?
Yeah, and then after that, I stuck the A initial in the middle for what ought to be glaringly obvious reasons.
Indeed, anyone who knows Jethro Tull will know why. But you, one of the tracks you've chosen is "Get in That Swing," and we're going to hear a bit of that now.
When you come on now? Do you mean all things? But first I want you get right now in that swing. I say, come on now, baby, come and do you mean all things? But now first I want you lot to get right in that swing. Now come on now, Mr. Don, you read between the lines. Makes this man to see.
Ian, the other track on this record that I wanted people to hear features a guest female vocalist, and I think this track is wonderful. It's called New Lonesome Day. What can you tell us about this from your album Stereo Death Breakdown?
Well, yes, at that time I was living in London, and therefore the Cousins was my home from home. And yeah, I think round about the time we did the album, I had a weekly residency there with my friend Al Jones. And yes, there was a young woman there who used to work behind the coffee bar who played harmonica. So we called her Harmonica Annie because her name was Annie. Well, you would, wouldn't you? And then a couple of weeks before we made the album, she got up and she suddenly started singing. And we all went, wow, where's this voice come from out of this little sort of 17-year-old person? And I was so amazed. I said to, you know, we're doing this album. Would you like to come along and sing on one track? And so we pulled out, it's loosely a Blind Willie McTell song, and pulled this out and said, here, would you like to sing this? And she did. Everybody thought it was Gianne Kelly.
It's a fantastic track. Let's have a listen. We're going to jump forward to 1966. From what I can tell from your book, you seem to spend most of that year dressed as a vampire, carrying a coffin-shaped guitar case around London. They were heady days. Do you still have the cape?
No, I don't know none of that stuff. And I'm afraid the guitar that was in the coffin-shaped case was taken off by somebody who never paid me for it, so who knows.
I'm sorry to hear that. And I actually, as a fellow picker and strummer of instruments of that shape, I found some of the laments for instruments no longer in your possession quite heartbreaking. I suppose you're old enough now to look back with fewer regrets and less angst about those kind of things. But you were the possessor of some beautiful and very fine instruments. And you still have the Thornbury, of course, which has been played by almost every significant roots artist in the world.
Well, so, most of the West African guitar players, anyway.
Well, yes. But it's a hard thing, isn't it, when instruments come and go, and their value really only is in what you do with them. They're not that's and you had the best of them, I suppose, at the time.
Yeah, well, I'm jealous of several people I know in Sheffield who have large collections of beautiful instruments. No names mentioned. Actually, one of them's got one that I used to have. But I just, you know, like many musicians, you can't afford to keep guitars you don't play. If your playing style is changing and you need something more suited to it, you can't afford to keep the previous one, and it's a shame. I've only got two real regrets, but I did work out the other day that I think over the years I've owned about 30 guitars. But the two Thornburys that Nigel Thornbury made for me in 1979 are still my main playing instruments.
Fantastic. Ian, it would take more than the time we have on this program to go through the book in the detail I would like to. So I'm going to be jumping a little bit around. But I think I would like you to tell me a bit more about Dave Evans, because this is an artist that I had not come across before. And what a revelation. I think from reading the book, that was probably the artist who, one of the artists anyway, who grabbed me hardest in terms of listening for the first time. Who was Dave Evans?
Well, Dave Evans was a man of many parts. He first came to Bristol in the days of our Village Thing label to play on Steve Tilston's first album. Steve introduced him to us. And he liked the Bristol scene so much that he promptly moved there. But he was just, he's one of these people who can do anything. He made his own guitars. He was a brilliant potter. He was a brilliant cook, songwriter, but incredibly modest with it. And if he'd been as pushy as, you know, other artists around, I'm sure he would have been extremely famous. At the time, it was exactly the same time where you're putting out Dave's two albums as Island were putting out Nick Drake. And at the time, nobody bought any Nick Drake records. We sold three times as many Dave Evans records on Village Thing. Yeah. But then that was it. Obviously, Nick Drake had a big revival later on. But it's, you know, he deserved more, but then he had a very contented life. He eventually moved to Belgium, where, you know, on top of all those other things he could enjoy, they have the best beer in the world.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's listen to Dave Evans now with Grey Lady Morning. Absolutely beautiful. And as Ian said, in many ways, you could argue a far better singer and guitarist than Nick Drake, but that is history. Here is Dave Evans.
So softly, you don't wake anyone. Come late in morning, don't let on how the day began. Keep the midday sun for midday, let him keep his midday people too. I don't care too much for midday, I just like to lie in the air with you. Come now, sleep now, Lady Grey. Hey, Lady Morning, burning, turning, turn your eyes again wild. Hey, Lady Morning, stirring, yawning, close your eyes again and smile. Lay safely, silky on my pillow, shelter for a little from the wind. out my sleepy morning glory. Let the day go chasing far behind. Come now, sleep now.
Alien Water, you've divided it roughly into chapters which sort of coincide with decades, and it seems to be quite a nice way of doing it. But the decades that you've lived through and that you've played music through, and you've been an organiser of music, you've been the editor of F Roots, which started as Southern Rag and then became Folk Roots and then became F Roots, which was the critical and crucial guide to what was happening on the British folk scene for many, many years, and is still missed by all of us, I think, who depended on it for many reasons. But did you find that the decade thing was something you had to sort of work into once you decided, or is it actually that your life has really been a series of decades?
I haven't really thought of that. I mean, the 1970s was easy because running Village Thing at the beginning, and then myself and Maggie Holland were the duo Hot Vultures, and we just gigged and gigged and gigged, hundreds and hundreds of gigs throughout the whole decade, mainly in mainland Europe. That was easy to do. The 80s was impossible because at the 80s, you know, Hot Vultures turned into the English country blues band. And then Tiger Moth, so that was playing music. But then during that decade, I ran several festivals. We started the magazine, we started another record label, all sorts of stuff. And in the end, in the book, I had to kind of separate the decade chapter into like four separate boxes because it was driving me mad trying to work out how I did it all.
Ah, the simplicity of the 1970s, Ian. The simple life, the VW... couple of guitars, just you and Maggie. Yeah. Although it sounds like you're lucky to be alive by the sounds of it, some of those drives through Europe.
Yeah. Well, in the 70s, Maggie was the driver.
Yes, indeed. You had some pretty hairy experiences, but you were very lucky to have Maggie driving you around, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
The Hot Vultures, you made, I think, three albums together?
Three albums. Yeah.
The track I'd like to play is from Up the Line, and it features Maggie's fantastic vocals. Can you tell me about this track? It's called Mistreated Mama.
I'm trying to think where we got that from. I think we first heard it from Sarah Gray. And then tracked it back to whatever the recording was that she'd probably got it from. My mind's a bit blank on that one. I could look it up. But Maggie, when we started Hot Vultures, she'd been a floor singer in clubs and was a good guitar player, but her voice was quite high and breathy. And then at some point, Martin Carthy poked her in the diaphragm and said, "You should be singing from down there." And around about that time, Frankie Armstrong was doing workshops where especially teaching women how to get the power into their voices. And she described what she called the "hey" voice, which is like, if you do that, if you're shouting at somebody to the other side of the street, where you produce that voice from is where you should be singing from. And within a few months, her whole voice had changed. But the great thing about it was that she could go from the new voice to the old voice, which meant she could do that whole Jimmy Rogers blue yodel thing, which is awesomely special.
Well, let's have a listen. This is from Hot Vultures, and this is Maggie with Ian on guitar leading Mistreated Mama. And we'll take a short break after this, and we're back with the second half of Thank Goodness It's Folk right after this here on Sheffield Live. Don't go away. More with Ian Anderson, our guest today, after the break.
Sad and lonely since my loving baby's gone away. Some days sadness, some days gladness. My loving baby's gone away. And I'm a mistreated mama, mama, with a mistreated blue. Once you said my kisses, they were oh so good. Now you're out tomcatting round the neighbourhood. I'm a mistreated mama, mama, with a mistreated blue. Once you shook the apples all off my tree. Now you're only handing back the pips to me. I'm a mistreated mama, mama, with a mistreated blue. Once you come home to me when the sun went down. Now I have to chase you up all over town. I'm a mistreated mama, mama, with a mistreated blue. Sad and lonely since my loving baby's gone away. Some days sadness, some days gladness. My loving baby's gone away. And I'm a mistreated mama, mama, with a mistreated blue.